Last time we were talking about Locke and his differences from the continental rationalists, people like Descartes and Leibniz. And I was saying that some of the changes that he made, he's basically a Cartesian. I mean, Locke's a dualist too. Human beings, a mind or soul, and a body. And in the wider world, there are physical things, physical properties such as weight, mass, density, solidity, and so on. And then there's a rational order to the world, which consists of the logic and mathematical order that makes our world a cosmos, something ordered rather than a chaos. So he's with Descartes right there. He's a Cartesian with differences. And whereas Descartes wanted to jump right to what is self-evident and necessary, and he regarded math and logic as the very fabric of reality. So much so that, you remember the slogan, the real is the rational and the rational is real. No, Locke won't go along with that. That's not right. There's a rational order to the world. We think in accordance to that when we use math and logic correctly. We get things right. That's right too, but the vast majority of what we know, of the ideas that come to us, are ideas of the external world. And he took that, the world outside of us, outside our minds, the same way Descartes did. It's physical. So the objects around us, think about what that means. The objects around us have only physical properties, or let's say only physical, spatial, and mathematical, quantitative properties. That's all. The objects around us don't have sensory properties. Right? I think you remember this. The view that these people had of sensation goes something like this. This is George Zilts. And George is looking at an object in his house. It's a vase with flowers in it. And what happens, according to what these guys all believe, is that light comes, strikes this, bounces off, comes through the pupil of George's eye, and makes a little upside down image on his retina of this vase with a flower in it. And this stimulates his optic nerve, which travels around to the occipital lobe of his brain, where it causes brain processes. Now, if you're a materialist, you want the story to end there. You say, as a materialist, as somebody who thinks that everything is only physical, that those physical brain processes are what we call a sensation. That's what we experience. They're actually brain processes, but that's not how we experience them. We don't experience brain processes. What we experience are sensations, and one of those is this sensation of the vase with the flowers. If you're not a materialist, and you are like all of these guys, then you believe that somehow those brain processes cause the perception, the copy of that vase to occur in your non-physical mind. That's what these dots are supposed to be. And the problem of interaction is, how do physical brain processes cause a change in something that's not physical, not in space, and so on. So this is the general view of how perception takes place. And Locke, I said to you last time, mistook, misdescribes, and never corrects himself about what it is we immediately experience. And instead of saying that it's concrete objects, objects with all their kinds of properties and laws, he says, no, it's disparate, discrete sensations that have only sensory properties. So color patches enter, sounds enter, tastes enter, touches, smells, so on. And our mind puts them together into an object. Well, if they do, that's not something we're ever conscious of. We're not describing then an operation of the mind we can reflect on. We can catch the mind doing it. No. We don't ever catch ourselves doing that. In fact, what we experience, if we're going to reflect on that, as he calls upon us to do, if we're to describe our experience, it's of whole objects with a multiplicity of properties, both active and passive, in relation to us. That's what I proposed to call concrete objects last time. So what argument can Locke give? How does he show us that what we experience initially is not whole objects, but individual sensations of all different sorts? Visual, auditory, gustatory, tactile. Well, here's what he says. Though the qualities that affect our senses are in the things themselves, so united and blended that there is no separation, no distance between them, yet it's plain that the ideas they produce in the mind enter by senses, simple and unmixed. For though the sight and touch often take in from the same object, at the same time, different ideas. The sight and touch take into the mind at the same time color patches and sensory, that is tactile sensations. They take them in separately. In the simple ideas, thus united in the same subject, though, are those that come in through the senses. The coldness and hardness that a man feels in a piece of ice are distinct ideas in the mind, that is, its coldness and its hardness. And they're as distinct as the smell and whiteness of a lily, or the taste of a sugar, or the smell of a rose. And there is nothing can be plainer to a man than the clear and distinct perception he has of these simple ideas, which being each in itself uncompounded, contains in it nothing but one uniform appearance or conception in the mind. That's all he gives us as a reason for this mistake. What he's doing is drawing an inference from this picture. I used light and the sense of sight. But according to Locke, George Zilch here may reach out and try to touch the object, in which case he gets a tactile sensation. You know, let's say that it's smooth and cool. And here he's getting color patches. And when he touches it, it makes a noise. So then sound waves travel to his ear and register in his ear. And instead of telling us that this picture is the result of us abstracting from the big picture that's given to us, the concrete objects that come to us in perception, that we can separate off the different kinds of properties and say that some come through this sense and some another. But what we sense in a very wonderful but mysterious way is the entire object with all its properties. And then we abstract from that, that is, abstract means separate off. We separate off the sensory from the physical, from the mathematical, from the spatial, from the logical, and so on. No, he has it backward. What comes to us are the individual sensations, and they have to be pieced together. And what's his argument for that? Listen again. And there can be nothing plainer to a man than the clear and distinct perception he has of these simple ideas. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds to me like an appeal to self-evidence. Right? Nothing's more obvious. Well, you can just see it's true, can't you? It's self-evident. So after wanting to rule out self-evidence, he appeals to it. He hasn't got any other reason for this view but that he claims it's self-evident. And anyway, I don't think it is. Not self-evident to me. What's self-evident to me is that he flipped the picture. What we experience are concrete objects. We abstract different kinds of properties and laws from them. But in some way that we can't explain, our senses take in different sorts of phenomena, but they're already combined in a thing when we experience it. Our mind doesn't piece it together so far as we can know by reflecting on it and reporting the operations that can be conscious to us. If the mind does do something that extraordinary, it would have to be unconscious. And I don't know any way to confirm that. My take on Locke. He sets us off in a healthy sort of direction and immediately falls into an error that is a significant one, because thinkers after him are going to follow him in this. They're not going to sniff out the mistake. They're going to go with what we experience is purely sensory. What comes in our mind, what gets there, are only colors, sounds, tastes, touches, smells. But wait a minute. If that's all that's in our minds to represent to us the external world, remember how that external world has already been described, according to Descartes, whose views also dominate this era. Everybody has to deal with Descartes in some way. So what can Locke say about this? He's now arguing that what's in our mind are only disparate sensations that our mind combines to represent objects, to represent. This is called the copy theory of perception. What we perceive in our minds are little copies of what's outside. But those outside objects have already been defined by Descartes as purely physical. In that, he was following Galileo. Galileo wanted to say, there's a purely physical world external to human minds. And that purely physical world operates any way it operates. And we're going to investigate it, and we're going to discover laws, and we're going to explain how the external physical world operates. And all of that has nothing to do with things like ethics and religion and religious belief and belief in God. It's a complete separation of the two. He wanted that because he didn't want the church censoring his work. He didn't want the church saying, oh, you can't say that the earth travels around the sun. If you do that, it's a heresy. And you'll be excommunicated, or worse. And he wants to say, no, the external physical world's off limits to theology and ethics. So physics is one thing, theology and ethics is another. His famous remark, it's very clever. He says, the Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So it's not going to give you your astronomy, but it is going to give you God's plan of salvation. I think you got that right. But anyway, Locke is following that here. There's an external world that's purely physical, and what comes into our minds, whoa, wait a minute, what did he say? He said what comes into our minds is purely sensory, has only colors, tastes, touch, sounds, and smells as properties. But the external world doesn't have them at all. The external world has only mass, weight, solidity, density, charge, physical properties, the properties studied by physics that relate to one another by physical laws. Well, now tell me this, this is going to be a good one. How can what is purely sensory and has no physical properties be a copy of something else that has only physical properties? You explain that trick and you'll go down in the books and people will read you hundreds of years from now. Can't be done. And the next thinker that we're taking up, George Berkeley, says exactly that to Locke. What's in the mind is purely sensory, that it can't be a copy of anything that's purely physical. And you can't tell me that it's a miracle caused by God, because even miracles can't be self-contradictory. Now, they all believe that too. They all believe that what was possible was whatever was not self-contradictory. You remember the rationalists wanted to say, in that case, it's not only possible, it's real. And these empiricists want to say, no, it's only possible. We have to go look and experience, look in the world to see if it's real. But they all believe that even miracles couldn't be self-contradictory. And they believe that because they thought the laws of logic were part of the being of God. So even God couldn't violate them. All right, I'm not dredging all that up. I've already critiqued that. But I want to say, right here and now, that what happens after Locke is because of Locke. He gives us the proposal that purely sensory perceptions that occur in our minds are faithful representatives and copies of external, purely physical objects. And how something that's only sensory can be a faithful copy of something that isn't sensory at all is not a trick he can pull off. And so Berkeley jumps on it, says that even that can't even be a miracle caused by God, because it's self-contradictory. You can't say that what's purely sensory is a faithful copy of something that has no sensory properties whatever, but only physical ones. And so Berkeley's going to proceed, we will soon find out, proceed to argue that all reality consists of are God, human minds, and the perceptions to which God gives to the human minds. What we call, what Descartes called the external physical world, is actually the internal sensory world. They're the same thing in Berkeley. Clever. Okay, we're not done with Locke. There are some other things that we have to talk about, and one is Locke's endorsement of the idea of substance. I already read the section where he says nothing can be plainer, sounds like self-evidence, than that his description is right. Well, what about the idea of substance? You remember that I spoke with you about this earlier, and I said that doing away with the idea of substance, I think, is the key to a distinctively Christian take on philosophy. And that's because, I'll call this the Christian view, says that only God is the self-existent, backward capital E means existence in logic, self-existent origin of all else. Everything other than God has been brought into existence by God. But this, in my understanding of the Christian view, is that a second thing comes from it. Only God, and we'll say God's power, is what, and the expression used is hangs all things together. establishes the network of relations between all kinds of things and events and states of affairs between the whole world and ourselves. And it's the second one that the vast majority of Christian thinkers missed. They said we could go on singling something out of the creation. As long as we don't say it's self-existent, it could be what hangs everything together, provided we add the statement, and this in turn depends on God. And we find Locke doing exactly that. Descartes did it. Descartes said that it's minds and bodies. Minds along with the rational order of the universe. So there's a rational order to creation. God gives humans minds that are in tune with the rational order, that can just intuitively see rational truths that, because of the experience of self-evidency. And then humans also have bodies that take part in the physical world. And Descartes calls mind and body, the rational order, and physical things, he calls secondary substances. Because it is those two things that stand under, that support all other things and hang them together and guarantee their relationships. Neither of them is self-existent. They're both created by God. But they give you the account of the world the rest of the way. So you just add, and God created these, and you've Christianized it. And now Locke is going to do the same thing. He's going to talk about substance, and substances are going to, again, be very similar to what Descartes said. He sees them, the substance of any object, as what hangs together all its properties and makes it that particular kind of thing. This idea we have, he says, to which we give the name substance, being nothing but the supposed but unknown support of those qualities we find existing, which we imagine cannot exist without being supported by something else. So we experience the kinds of properties that objects exhibit to us as dependent. None of them is the kind that can exist on its own. And I think that's absolutely right. And we will close this course on an argument that I have that I think definitely establishes that, and which has no comeback. And you can judge for yourself when we come to that last lecture. I'll give you an argument in favor of this. That none of the properties that we do experience things around us to have could be the nature of what is self-existent, because none of them can be conceived of as existing on its own. So Locke very wisely says about substance, it's something we know not what. It's not any of the properties that we see. Descartes said it's the rational order plus the physical order of the universe. Locke won't say that. He says, can't do that. Neither physical things could exist on their own, nor can the rational order exist on its own. So there must be something else that is the substance. And that's what he changes this to. He calls it substance is what hangs the things together, but it is a something I know not what. And it's a great pity, it seems to me, that having come to this realization, which is better than anybody before him, including even Descartes, he sees that he can't put into that slot any created property of any created thing. It doesn't occur to him to say, oh, according to Colossians chapter 1, it's God that does that. It's only God's power that goes into that slot. That's what hangs all things together. You remember we went over this at some length. God has created all things, visible or invisible, through Jesus Christ, and in Him all things hang together. Had he seen that, he would have seen the key to a truly Christian approach, I think, to philosophy, because after him, everybody goes back to the idea of substance, and they're still doing it. And even the pragmatists of our own day, you know, this is for later, a later session, more detail, but the pragmatists of our own day who want to get rid of all religious belief and not have anything occur in a philosophy that is either specifically taken to be self-existent or just assumed tacitly to be self-existent. We're going to get rid of it all. They still tacitly assume something is self-existent. It can't really be escaped. So all those are treats yet to come in the final lectures. So, the properties of things as we find them are such that they cannot exist on their own. To support them, we call that support substance, which according to the true import of the word is in plain English standing under or upholding. Of the sorts of substances, well, an obscure and relative idea of substance in general is thus that we come to have ideas of particular sorts of substances by collecting such combinations of simple ideas which in our experience and in the observation of men's senses take notice to exist together, and they are therefore supposed to flow from the particular internal constitution or unknown essence of the substance. So we see all these properties, they're combined in things, we distinguish things by the kinds of properties they have actively and passively. I added that. And then we attribute what hangs all that together, organizes a thing into a law-governed organization, so that a thing isn't just a heap of properties. And it's not just a bundle. It's law organized, and all of its properties are so thoroughly integrated into it that we can't conceive of any kind apart from all the other kinds. I'm adding that, but that's in effect what he's saying. We can't get them apart even mentally. So that's what gives us the idea that there must be a something that supports, unifies, and them all into one thing. So I experience the stylus as one thing. And this book, which I'm reading Locke to you from. If we burn them up, there's no more thing. That's true. But so long as they exist, they are one thing, hung together by something he wants to call substance I know not, but I know not what it is. And I think that's where Christian ought to say it's nothing more than the power of God exercised, mediated to all creation through Jesus Christ in his divine and human nature. This is how we come to have ideas of a man, horse, gold, water, and so on, of which substances, whether anyone has any other clear idea, further than that of a simple idea is coexisting together, I appeal to everyone's own experience. It's in the ordinary qualities observable in iron or a diamond put together that make the true complex of those substances which a smith or a jeweler commonly knows better than a philosopher. I think that's right too. So, as a clear an idea of spiritual substance, we have as clear an idea of substances being non-physical things as being physical things. Same thing happens concerning the operations of our minds, thinking, reasoning, fearing, and so on, which we conclude not to subsist of themselves. There's no such thing as fearing, thinking, feeling that just exists by themselves. No, it's minds that have to do that. So then the mind is the substance of the mental things. So, which they don't exist themselves, nor do we see how they could be produced or belong to the body. Which it doesn't make much sense, he thinks, to say that, he's thinking of the body as purely physical, right? The purely physical body fears something or knows something or is explaining something. No, that's nonsense, he says. We're apt to think of these actions as inhering in something as a substance. And so we use the word spirit. So there are spirits and bodies, and they interact. It's the same problem there that Descartes does. He can't explain interaction. But it's our common experience that, for these reasons, what the capacities that we by which we know, decide, judge, feel, perceive, have to be the properties of a non-physical thing. Whereas the properties by which we stand up and sit down, move, eat, they're a physical thing, a body. The others, they're not of the body, we call spirit. And it's by supposing a spiritual substance when we are thinking, knowing, doubting, moving, that we have as clear a notion of the spiritual substance as we have of the body. It is in both cases the substratum, that which lies underneath and supports all else. So he endorses the idea of substance. He's building his theory of reality. And just as these considerations lead us to the idea of substance, the idea of substance, remember there are two kinds. There are physical substances, and there are, he calls it, spiritual. Each human spirit is substance as well. Two kinds. But this idea is what gives rise to the concept of cause. Now, without causality, we're not going to explain anything about the natural world around us. We need a clear concept of causality in order to explain how physical things interact, biological living things interact, and so on, and for how human bodies act in response to the command of the mind of spirit or soul. So that's why he's saying it's the idea of substance that leads to the idea of causality. So here's what he says. He says that because we directly experience in our own mind, spirit, or soul that we want our arm to move, and then our arm moves, that's the sense in which we directly experience causality. We don't perceive an object called causality. Okay, it's not that we, in addition to our arm, we also perceive a force that has some color, shape, size, location, quantity, and that is causality. No, we come to the idea of causality because we experience our bodies respond to our mental commands to it. So when I will my hand to take the fork, pick up a piece of steak, and put it in my mouth, that's what happens. And if it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen repeatedly, we call for medical attention to say something's really wrong. So we all come to the idea of causality because we experience it as part of our own personal experience. Here we make a command given to our arm, and we don't have to say the words, we can just want it. And the result is that the arm moves. And that's where we get the idea of cause. And that's why when we see in the natural world around us, one rock crashes into another, and then one or the other maybe falls apart, we say it's the crash that caused the rock to rupture into pieces. Because we see something happening that's so like what happens when we will our bodies to do, you know, to move, to stand up, sit down, eat, whatever. So he's not only endorsed the idea of substance, but he's saying that we then attribute to inanimate things in nature the same sort of relationship. It's not that one rock wants to break the other. We're not saying that. It doesn't have the mental properties, but it does have the physical causality. Now, I'm finding a spot in Locke I wanted you to hear. Okay. Since the mind, in all its thoughts and reasonings, has no other immediate object but its own ideas, which it alone does or can contemplate, it's evident that our knowledge is only conversant about them. Knowledge then seems to me, this is Locke speaking, to be nothing but the perception of the connection of an agreement or disagreement of any of our ideas. So what we're aware of and what we explain and what we know is in here. All our thoughts. And the argument for that is, listen closely, it's evident that our knowledge, does that sound like self-evident to you? I have to say it does to me. He's saying that given the theory that I've outlined so far, it's self-evident that we know only what's inside our minds. If you thought Descartes was bad, because he ended up with what we know being inside our heads, Locke's just as bad in that respect. What we don't know is the external world. Why? Why should we take that view? I think it stems from viewing the external world as purely physical. It goes back to Galileo's proposal that that's the way we see things, so that we can separate off doing science from concerns of theology or ethics. Why consider the external world purely physical? Why isn't it the case that the objects around me are what I perceive? I perceive the external world. And the colors that these things have are the colors of the surfaces of those objects. I don't see anything bad that follows from that. And the proponent of a Cartesian or Lockean view would say, well, I do. How do you explain this? Isn't it, Case, I mean, you're going to have to agree with me that if we put a stick into water, it looks bent. This part, the part that's underwater, looks as though it's bent to us, when in fact, though, really, the stick is straight. right? Well, doesn't that show you then that the stick is one thing and our perception is another? The stick can't be both bent and not bent at the same time. But our perception is bent. Therefore, our perception is not of the stick. It's something produced in us by light bouncing off the stick and so on. But the stick can't be both bent and not bent, so we got to be dealing with two things here. Or take another example. We're standing at a railroad track, and we see the tracks go off ahead of us, and the tracks appear to us to converge at the distance. Do the tracks really converge? Do they really come together? If we walk down to that spot where it looked, what we're going to see is the railroad tracks just as far apart there as they were back when it looked as though they had converged here. So our perception has to be something different, a different thing from what it is that the light is bouncing off of and coming through into our sight. There are other examples, of course. Things that we perceive as smaller the further away they are. But they're not really smaller, are they? So doesn't all that show that our perceptions are one thing and the objects are something else? We've got to have two things here. And my answer to that is no, we don't have to do that at all. What we can say is that the railroad tracks have the sensory property of appearing to converge at a distance. Why can't they have that property along with all the other properties that they have? That any object has the property to appear diminished in size the greater distance it is from my eyes. Why can't it have that just as well as the property of appearing yellow or appearing to be heavy or any other characteristic I want to name? And I'm saying this of things, thinking of the things, the objects, as multi-sided, as having many kinds of properties and laws. And I maintain that all of those kinds are conveyed through normal sense perception. It isn't just because the eye is sensitive only to light and the tongue only to color and the nose only to smell and the fingertips only to touch and so on, that's all that comes in. What comes in through the senses are entire objects, landscapes, and more. And what comes in has many kinds of properties, not just sensory properties. The sensory is one kind that we abstract off of what we experience. And then to turn around and try to reduce everything to being that, oh, then that's all that really comes in. That doesn't follow either. Our senses are made so that they take one kind of sensation at a time. The eyes only take sight, not touch or smell. The taste buds taste and not touch or sight, and so on. But from that it does not follow that only those properties enter through the senses. It's a faithful jump that never been justified. Neither has it ever been justified that Galileo was right in his proposal. The external world's only physical. Well, then nothing can be a copy of it. Because copies can only be sensory. They have to be things perceived. It's a hopeless mishmash. And one piece of it is failing to see that the idea of substance is in fact an idea of a God substitute. In the place in the philosophy where only God should go, that is, that he is not only created, but maintains and holds together in functional coherence all of creation. Not give that to anything or anybody else, but say, no, that's how we must start a Christian philosophy. So a theory of reality done from that point of view begins by not putting anything into the slot of being the substance on which everything else depends. There's nothing in creation that is that. That's only the power of God through Christ. God not only mediates his saving power to his creatures through Jesus Christ, he maintains his sustaining power through his creative and sustaining power. That's what Colossians 1 says. Through Christ he has created all things, and in him, in Christ, all things hang together. Don't put matter into that slot, or matter plus form, or the rational order of the world plus physical things. None of the candidates are right. And that would give us an ontology whereby we would look for the natures of kinds of things, but not the overall nature of all creation. Because the overall nature of all creation is not to be physical, or to be physical and rational, or any of the other picks. The overall nature of the entire cosmos is to depend on God. It's to be God's creation. So we're not looking for the same thing that other philosophies look for that start with the idea of substance. I'm happy then when I see that Locke realizes he can't put any kind of properties and laws that he can distinguish in the things that we experience into that slot. None of them are going to work as substance. Descartes thought you could, the physical and the rational. Locke says, no, we can't put any of them there. They all look to me dependent. That's his Christianity showing through. It's God created them all. They all look dependent. Yes, that's right, Locke. And none of them therefore can be substance that holds the whole creation and all kinds of properties and all the laws that hold, makes them what they are, sustains them in existence, relates everything so that all things do hang together. But then you said, well, there has to be something go in that, so it must be a something I know not what. And that's very disappointing. He leads you right up the step he needs to see a Christian take on theories and steps back. Pity. And regret seeing that. But he then speaks of that, how we know others, out external world, and how we know other people. Locke's answer about the external world is that we see and feel them. We know them by our sensory apparatus, and that satisfies everyone. He doesn't use the term self-evidence. I would. I think what we experience as self-evidently so, unless we can detect a hologram or an hallucination. We have reason to believe somebody slept us a Mickey and now we're seeing the world crazy. But Locke himself puts it this way. Having the idea of anything in our mind no more proves that it exists than a picture of a man is evidence of his being in the world, or visions of a dream make a true history. For example, the whiteness of this paper, is it therefore the actual receiving of ideas from outside ourselves that gives us notice of the existence of other things and makes us to know that something does exist and that the time without us? And that's what causes the idea in us. So while I write this, I have, by the paper affecting my eyes, the idea produced in my mind of the white paper, which whatever object causes, I call white, and by which I know that quality does really exist and has a being independent of me. And of this, the greatest assurance I can possibly have, and to which my powers can attain, is the testimony of my eyes, that are the proper and sole judges of this thing. And that's as certainly as great as human nature is capable of, to concerning the existence of anything except for a man's self and God. So he's saying, in effect, that normal sense perception conveys certainty about itself. And that's what I mean when I say it's self-evident. And he says it's as certain as anything except our own, the way our own existence is to us, and the certainty that we have that God exists. The certainty of ourselves and God may be more intense and more thorough than our certainty about what we see around us. But what we see around us comes in second and not by a lot. When we have a normal perception, such as seeing this paper white, that's as good as we're going to get. And we shouldn't ask for proof that there's, that the paper's real and that it's white, and so, because that stuff is conveyed in normal perception. And normal perception, it's evident to us, he says. And he leaves out self. Self-evident to us that this is so. So I said to you, he's going to do away with self-evidence and then use it. And that's what we're catching him doing. I said that because I've read Locke before. So what about real existence? How can we tell whether what we're experiencing is a realistic dream or an hallucination, or we could add, or a hologram or something like that? How do we know we're not being fooled? Some of the time, Locke assumed that all our simple ideas that come to us do simply represent real realities. So, and other times he seems to realize that it's a problem he hasn't solved. Keep in mind, Locke still wants reality to be basically rational. He's not going to say that the rational is real. It's not that whatever fantasy picture you can contrive, like that of monads, is real if it's rational. If there's no contradiction, then it's right. He doesn't believe that. But he does believe the real is rational. The real is permeated by laws, laws of mathematics, laws of logic. They apply to the world. The world really has the property of, things in the world really have the property of conforming to those laws. And it has other kinds of order, as physical order, biological order, and so on. So he wants to take the first part of that slogan. The real is rational. That's okay. It's capable of being explained, and I'm going to do it. But it doesn't follow that whatever is rational, whatever we care to invent, as long as it doesn't contradict itself, is real. No, that he's not going along with. So he gives an account then of how it is that people have become aware of the sensations as revealing to them objects external to them. And this is knowledge of relations. It is the first act of the mind, when it has any ideas at all, to perceive its ideas. And so far as it perceives them, to know each what each one is, and therefore also to perceive their differences, and that one idea is not another. This is what we would call perceptions. Right? He calls them ideas. They're things that exist in minds. This is so absolutely necessary that without it there could be no knowledge at all. By this, the mind clearly and infallibly perceives each idea to agree with itself and to be what it is, and all distinct ideas to be different. And that is evident without proof, not inferred from any other information, and infallible. But he doesn't use self-evident. See, I think the three restrictions on self-evident are false. And we'll talk about that. I think that the requirement that everybody agree with you is one you could never know were true or false, because you can't know what people a million years ago thought or a million years from now are going to think. But just because you can't check it doesn't mean it couldn't be right. It's worse than that. Not being able to tell is just the beginning. We'll do it in some detail down the line. But you see how he's dealing with self-evidence without using the word, because he doesn't want to have to show that everybody agrees with him and that he's only talking about laws. And because right here he's not. He's not talking about laws. He's talking about perceptions, which are not laws. And that they coexist, and that they're different, that each one is perfectly consistent in itself and different from the others. And that's so obvious as to be infallible. Sorry, Charlie. Doesn't have to be infallible or any of those things to be self-evident. We'll continue with Locke's account next time. We ran out of time. See, when you're having fun, the time does fly.